for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Last week, the east coast of the U.S. got hammered by record snowstorms. This brought out climate change skeptics who said the extreme weather was proof that global warming is a hoax. Joining me in the studio for an update on addressing climate change issues, John Broder of the New York Times, Frank Masano, an energy expert, and Steve Cochran of the Environmental Defense Fund. We will take your calls. Join us 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. You can also join us on Facebook and Twitter. Before we begin our conversation with our guests here in the studio, joining us by phone is Jane Lubchenco. She's administrator of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Good morning to you. It's good to have you.
Hi, Diane. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. Last week, we saw some really unusual weather patterns, not only through the Mid-Atlantic, but even today in the southern part of the United States. What do you think has made this year so different?
Diane, I think it's important that people recognize that weather is not the same as climate. And record-breaking storms neither negate nor prove climate change. This year, we have indeed seen a lot of seemingly strange things, record snowfalls in the Mid-Atlantic region, even though the planet is warming. And this isn't a contradiction, and it's not really unexpected. Here's why. Even though overall the planet is getting warmer, weather can be highly variable. And this year's winter weather is being strongly influenced by the interaction between two significant factors, both of which vary from year to year. Number one, El Nino is sending wet, stormy weather across the southern United States and then sometimes up the East Coast. And two, the Arctic Oscillation is pushing cold air down from the Arctic. And when an El Nino-driven storm meets up with cold air from the Arctic, opportunities for very significant snow result. And so the multiple snowstorms we've been seeing this winter, with more on the way likely, are a result of the confluence of El Nino and the Arctic Oscillation.
And do you see this pattern likely to continue then?
El Nino continues to be underway, and typically in winters with an El Nino like this year's, we see a series of storm after storm after storm slamming into California, coming across the southern U.S., and so that pattern is indeed likely to continue for the foreseeable future.
Help me to understand this new National Climate Service.
The NOAA Climate Service that we announced the intent to create last week will be a comprehensive and integrated office responsible for sharing NOAA's climate science, our data, our information, and services. So we intend it to be one-stop shopping for users across the nation, much in the same way that NOAA's National Weather Service has been providing weather information and services for 140 years.
And I gather that that won't begin until sometime in 2011.
We hope it will be in place by October of this year. It does have to go through an approval process through the Office of Management and Budget and Congress. And so we hope that by the beginning of next fiscal year, which is October, that it will be in place.
one last word from you, Jane, and that is what your reaction is to the growing sense around the country and perhaps even around the world that global warming is a hoax.
We are seeing increasing calls for information about climate change. And one of the reasons we created the National Climate Service, the NOAA Climate Service, is to provide the kind of information that people are increasingly seeking. Climate change is underway. It's happening now. It is resulting in many changes that will affect the way people live and do business. And the fact that we are getting more and more requests for information about droughts, about future heat waves, about air quality, forest fires, sea level rise, inundating coasts, and other phenomena tells us that a lot of people, while not completely sure what's going on, are asking for information. And this NOAA Climate Service, I believe, will help provide that information so people can make decisions based on it.
Jane Lubchenco, she's administrator at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Diane.
And turning now to you here in the studio, John Broder, how is this anti-climate change feeling gaining traction?
Well, it's gaining traction for a number of reasons, one of which is there's always been a vigorous community of skeptics about the science of climate change. And they are increasingly using the internet and the airwaves, sympathetic radio and television broadcasters, to get their message across. There's obviously a paralysis in Congress about what to do about climate and energy legislation, which is driving sort of the political side of the movement as opposed to the scientific side of the movement. And there have been a number of errors and missteps made by climate scientists that we have seen both in the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report and in some emails that were released without authorization from a major client, climate institute in England.
Explain some of the details of those errors.
Okay. Well, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which issued its most recent comprehensive report in 2007, and for which it won the Nobel Prize, which it shared with Al Gore, has acknowledged a number of errors and poorly sourced assertions in its recent reports, including how fast the Himalayan glaciers are melting, how much and how quickly the Amazon rainforest is disappearing, and even how much of the Netherlands is permanently underwater. And that's been an embarrassment to this scientific body, which is a group of scientists around the world, like 3,000 of them, contribute to these reports. They're not paid for it. It's a volunteer effort. And apparently it was there were some serious editing errors. The other side of the coin is the emails that were released from the University of East Anglia in England that appear to show scientists almost colluding among themselves or perhaps conspiring to keep critical material out of IPCC and other public reports. And that has been damaging to the credibility of the whole science community.
How significant was the information that those few scientists tried to keep out?
Well, it's a highly technical debate. One of the issues about it was something called the hockey stick graph, which is very familiar to people who follow this issue. And that shows roughly 1,000 years of steady global temperatures and then suddenly rising starting in the 1850s or so when industrialization came along and we began burning significant amounts of fossil fuel, coal and oil to power our economies. And the global temperatures have risen in a steady basis since then. The climate emails seemed to show was that there was a trick, so-called, that was used in putting that graph together. The scientists can explain that all that they meant by a trick was a clever way of combining two different sets of data. But the skeptics seized on that as some sort of evidence of malfeasance.
All right, and one last question before we go to a break. You talked about the political divisions over climate change. Are there the same kinds of massive scientific differences on the subject?
Well, I haven't spoken to every single senator or every member of the House of Representatives, but I think the overwhelming number of them actually believe that the climate is changing in ways that are potentially dangerous to mankind and the other inhabitants of the Earth. What they don't agree on is how to address it, the political and economic costs, how the burden of addressing climate change and reducing our fossil fuel use should be shared geographically, and it's a very difficult puzzle. It's almost harder than the scientific puzzle.
And what about the scientific side? Do you indeed have a majority of respected scientists who do believe the climate is warming and that warming is man-made?
Well, I will assert that you will get a lot of mail on it because neither of us has spoken to a majority of scientists or thousands of scientists, but I believe that there is an overwhelming scientific consensus that the climate is warming, humans are responsible.
John Broder, energy and environment reporter of The New York Times. We'll take just a short break now. When we come back, we'll talk further. Take your calls and email. Stay with us. And we're back as we talk about climate change, the fact that many of the snowstorms, the inclement weather we've experienced not only here in Washington but around the country. I think last Saturday it was said that there was snow on the ground in 49 of the 50 states. Excepting for Hawaii. And some people said that in the uppermost part of those mountains, there might have been some snow even there. Joining us by phone now is Myron Ebel. He's Director of Energy and Global Warming Policy at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Good morning to you, sir. Thanks for joining us. Myron Ebel, are you there? Oh, dear. He dropped off. Well, let's see if we can get him back. And we have other guests here in the studio. Steve Cochran is director of the Environmental Defense Fund's climate campaign. Steve, you say the climate change deniers have a $300 million war chest. Where is that coming from?
I think our experience in this country is that any time the status quo is challenged, that the people who currently benefit from the status quo are pretty good at putting together efforts to try to keep things as they are. And so you find a lot of funding that comes from the various traditional fossil fuel industries and some aspects of ideological funding in there as well.
All right. So now, Myron Ebel, are you back with us?
Yes, I hope so.
I hope so, too. Give us your perspective on climate change.
Well, I've been listening to Jane Lubchenco and John Broder, and I think that some of what they said is absolutely correct, and some of it is somewhat misleading. You know, we've had a lot of snow this winter. That doesn't say anything about global warming in particular, but I don't recall the shows last year when we didn't have any snow in Washington, D.C. and New York City, when people like Bobby Kennedy Jr. were getting a lot of press saying, oh, this is exactly what we're going to have with global warming. The snow is going to go away. The snow that we grew up with when we were children, it's not going to be around. In fact, the IPCC report, the most recent one, says pretty clearly that in the mid-latitudes there will be less snow in the winter. So this doesn't disprove global warming, but it certainly isn't consistent with the story we've been told. The second thing I'd say is John Broder talked about the ClimateGate scandal and the IPCC. This is a much bigger scandal, I think, than he gave an indication of. This is not just a few scientists saying nasty things in private in their emails. It's not just about a trick. It's about data manipulation on a very large scale to prove more or less what John Broder said, which is we've had a steady rise in temperature since the 19th century till today. And what we found is that they were turning down the temperature data. They were lowering it in the 1930s in many cases, and they were raising it for no apparent reason in recent decades to get a nicer story of warming. And I think that Phil Jones, the director of the CRU over in England, this weekend was quoted in several London papers saying, well, yeah, that's right. You know, the medieval warm period, this is what the hockey stick is about. The medieval warm period was probably warmer than today. So I think this scandal is much more damaging to the credibility of the IPCC and the kind of what I would call the climate establishment than is being made out.
Myron, tell me, do you think that the planet is just fine?
Well, I think that the climate is changing all the time, and I think human beings have something to do with that. But I think that these scare stories that have been trumpeted for years by the IPCC and by the alarmist community, for example, the one that has been shown to have no basis in scholarly research, that the Himalaya glaciers are rapidly melting, shows, I think, that there has been a tremendous amount of exaggeration of the bad news, the crisis, that it's here, it's now, and it's terrible. I think that the climate has been warming up a little. Human beings probably have something to do with it. The effects and the impacts are very mild, very modest. And I think that we're being sold essentially a bill of goods to try to force us to change, to turn our economy upside down.
A bill of goods, John Broder, what's your reaction?
Well, if one were to believe that, one would have to believe a very widespread global conspiracy of scientists. And yes, the work of some of them and their sincerity and perhaps even academic integrity has been called into question. But this is a very large group of people who have been reporting on these trends for many, many decades and tend to see the same thing. Now, I think Mr. Imbel has a point in that where the science crosses over into policy advocacy, there are some fairly significant questions to be raised. Scientists are supposed to stay out of the political debate. Politicians are supposed to weigh science versus economic and other impacts when considering addressing a legislative solution to, you know, what is in large measure a global and scientific problem. But is the public being sold a bill of goods? I'm not so sure.
John Broder, he's an energy and environment reporter for The New York Times. Frank Masano, as one who specializes in energy policy, is this debate all about money?
Well, it's partly about money, Diane. And I think what we've seen here is that the science argument really hasn't been that important to the policy debate for going on 10 years now. And that's an interesting sidebar to this whole back and forth tennis match that we're seeing between climate skeptics and scientists who have advocated and almost cheerleaded for years to have tougher policies. The reality is, the political reality is, that we can't adopt an economic structure, a policy structure that can get us to the level that environmentalists want us to get to, 350 parts per million in the atmosphere, and afford it. And so, yes, it is about money on the bottom line, but it's about money in the pocketbooks of people who, as John said earlier, regionally use coal in more cases than in some. It will affect places that use that type of power to generate their power through coal. It will affect people at the lower income, the lower spectrum of the income level, because people in poverty, of course, are often more affected by fixed cost increases, and these policies will have cost increases associated with them. Now, you can say in some cases perhaps they may be moderated by paybacks from the revenue brought in or by cleaner energy becoming cheaper and things like that. But the reality is there is a cost to all of this, and it's often borne most by consumers and most by consumers below the poverty level.
Steve Cochran, would you say this debate is all about money, or is it about science?
I think Frank is right that it's probably been a decade since science was the critical feature of this, and that's largely because, apart from the sort of cyclical nature of criticism that comes and goes in this process, that the vast majority of scientists do in fact believe climate change is real, and that we need to take our responsibility as humans, since we've contributing to it. So then the question is, what do you do about it? And in this particular case, it will always be a very large discussion about money. That's just the nature of any of these discussions. We're talking about a transition away from the basic production and distribution of energy that we've depended on for years that have created the quality of life we have, to other forms of energy, other more secure forms of energy, perhaps, than we've traditionally depended on. And so people who are making money in one side are going to oppose, and people who are going to make money on the other side are going to support. And that's going to be the nature of every big debate that comes along. I think one of the practical questions here is, let's say they're not, but let's say that the scientists are wrong. Let's say that climate isn't the kind of significant issue that we think it is. And we do smart policy in this area. What do we get? We get cleaner, safer, more secure forms of energy. We get a healthier environment. We get more efficient economic opportunities than we currently have. We have all of those things if the scientists are wrong. Now, if the scientists are right and we do smart policy, now we can do stupid policy, but if we do smart policy, we get those things and we actually prevent what could be the most significant environmental disaster that any of us have ever faced.
What about that, Myron Ebel?
I don't think that the story that Steve has laid out there, that everything will be rosy if we commit to a new energy economy, the kind of thing that President Obama is always talking about, is realistic. The fact is that we are pricing ourselves out of the world economy. We are making consumers poorer by raising energy prices. None of these new technologies, and I'm not against them, I'm for them. I hope some of them have breakthroughs and become competitive. But right now, the things that environmental groups like Environmental Defense Fund are pushing are things that require government subsidies and government mandates. Why? Because they're more expensive than the alternative. That means higher consumer prices, higher prices for manufactured goods, higher prices for transportation. This is a way to make ourselves considerably poorer, and it is not all about a wonderful new world of opportunities. It's a wonderful, it's a terrible new world of constrictions on a human flourishing throughout the world, not just in the United States. So this is a very serious issue, the cost issue. People continually say, oh, but these things will become competitive. We've had subsidies for many of these forms of energy since the 1970s. And whenever the subsidy expires, Congress hasn't gotten it reauthorized yet, the industry goes down. Nobody will build a windmill or a solar panel until they're confident they're going to get the subsidy. So I've got to say, this is a costly new world we're looking at, where people are going to be considerably poorer.
Myron Ebel, he's Director of Energy and Global Warming Policy at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. And you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. What about his points, John Broder?
Well, I didn't really come here to debate Mr. Ebel, but I would raise the issue of nuclear power, for instance. This is something that the Obama administration has supported. He supported it in his campaign. He mentioned it prominently in the State of the Union address. And more importantly, he has devoted an additional $38 billion or $36 billion in subsidies for the nuclear industry. I think that's a sign of his seriousness about trying to convert to a low-carbon economy, as well as a political olive branch to the opposition. Many of the Republicans who are wary of things like solar panels and windmills, which are an expensive form of generating energy, are very enthusiastic about nuclear power, which happens to be one of the most expensive ways of generating electricity that exists on the planet right now because of the problems or questions about safety, liability, siting. But the administration is wholeheartedly embracing that. So that's one place where perhaps the skeptics and the enthusiasts can come together.
Frank Mazzano, yeah. Do you see that possibility?
I think John is right. I don't know how much the president really believes, though, that nuclear is the right way to go. He has taken one of the major problems with nuclear waste, which is Yucca Mountain, and completely wiped it off the table. Of course, working closely with Senator Reid, who has been a longtime opponent, Majority Leader Reid, who has been a longtime opponent of that, and is, of course, in the toughest reelection of his entire career. So there's a lot of politics at play here. Energy traditionally is one, and environment are traditionally the bottom of the list of issues that people really care about, except for when it's in their own little area or something they deal with specifically. So I think it's easy to be magnanimous and make predictions about what you're going to be for that eventually isn't going to pan out. And so I really do. I wonder if he's serious. I wonder if Republicans are that serious. I think we have to get back to the most important part of this debate. What can we do today in the policy framework which starts us down a road toward making an achievable solution to address this issue long term? I don't think it's as dramatic as environmentalists and environmental policy as seen in some of the bills that have been put forward already in Congress. I think it's going to have to be a lot softer first step.
Steve Cochran.
I think as is always the case when some of these things are pretty contentious, there's some really significant opportunities here because Americans do care particularly now about jobs. They care about opportunities. They care about where those jobs are going to come from now and moving forward. And there's a pretty strong case to be made economically as you look at what's going on around the world. Certainly, Europe is moving ahead of the United States in its investments and its locations of manufacturing facilities. Those are real jobs. Looking at what China's doing, in fact, we're losing the race for the substantial new markets associated with the new energy economy because we're simply not focusing. I think Frank's point is one on which we agree. The question before the Congress is how quickly can we put in place the kind of signals, and even Myron and I might agree on this, market-based signals that say to the marketplace there will be incentives in place through the market, through private investment, through private decision-making that will reward innovators, entrepreneurs, people who move rapidly in this direction because that's how we create jobs that we need in America.
But, Steve, considering the growth of the anti-climate change movement, do you believe that any of that can really be accomplished?
So one of the things that I just talked about didn't even talk about climate. I think it's an incredibly important subject. But I also know that if we're smart about it and if we kind of quit arguing about the science instead of focus on the policy opportunities that are in front of us, we could actually make real progress.
What do you think about that, Frank?
Well, that's a point I've been making for a long time in this debate, back to the late 90s. But you know, one of the things that I want to also mention in relation to Steve's point is that I work on projects and getting them cited individually as well. And I've been working for 8 years on wind turbine projects and siting wind turbine projects in Western Maryland and Western Virginia, and we still can't get across the finish line on a lot of those projects because of the regulatory challenges of doing it for the first time, because of the burdens, and because people, frankly, don't want to oppose them. And that's a real difficult challenge.
Frank Mazzano, he's an energy policy specialist. We'll take just a short break. We'll come back and open the phones.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. By the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, working to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. This is NPR.
In 1987, President Reagan said the now famous words, "Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall."
Well, Gorbachev was a little bit irritated because he felt that he had already done a lot and was doing a lot to help end the Cold War.
On the next Fresh Air, David Hoffman, author of The Dead Hand, the untold story of the Cold War arms race and its dangerous legacy. Join us.
We're ready to open the phones. Let's go first to Scottsdale, Arizona. Michael, you're on the air.
Thank you, Diane and guests. I'm thrilled about the discussion taking place concerning science, technology, greenhouse effects, everything. But my question stems from almost 1974, when I had an eighth grade science teacher drawing a stick figure of a home on the chalkboard, showing here's our depletion of the ozone layer. Why has a discussion only concerning this topic taken place maybe the past 10, 15 years when you had a new graduate from college back then having this information?
Steve Cochran.
If I understand the question about why are we only recently talking about global warming, well, in fact, they've been at it for a while. If you go back... there's a good book that a professor named Gus Speth wrote a few years ago, Red Sky at Morning. He talks about when he worked back in 1980 in the President's Office of Council of Environmental Quality, where the first studies on global warming began to pile up on his desk. So we've been at this for a while. What finally reached the tipping point is just the massive evidence that suggested how important it was to get serious about this. And that occurred in the last 15 years.
John Broder, what happened? What was accomplished at Copenhagen?
Well, you can look at it two ways, and you know, I hate to be on the one hand, on the other hand, kind of a reporter here, but in fact, that's my job. There are people who say that very little was accomplished, and in fact, it was a setback for the entire global warming movement,
why?
If you will. Because for 2 weeks, the major countries argued about the form and the format of any sort of agreement that would be done there. It was more or less agreed from the beginning there wasn't going to be an international treaty that came out of it. In fact, what came out of it was evidence of a broad and perhaps unbridgeable difference between still the developed countries and the developing nations. The glass half full group think that the conference accomplished a couple of historic things. One, all the countries except perhaps six agreed to a statement that it was in the globe's interest, in everybody's interest, to keep global warming below 2 degrees above pre-industrial levels. That's a historic statement that had never been made before, never been agreed to by the community of nations. And the second and perhaps even more important accomplishment was that all the major countries there, the major emitters, agreed to sign up and put down on paper, in writing, a pledge that they are going to reduce their carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gas emissions by X percent by 2020. China had never done that before. Brazil had never done that before. India had never done that before. The United States had never done that before.
So something was accomplished, but wasn't there supposed to be a January 31st deadline for the major countries to submit exactly what they would do?
As of January 31st or February 1st, at least 90 countries representing over 80% of global emissions had done just that. And analysts have looked at those pledges and added them all together, and it comes pretty close to the 2-degree target if the countries meet their pledges by 2020.
What of course, about China and the U.S.?
China and the U.S. put down pledges. The United States' promise was dependent on Congress acting, and that's still an open question.
Frank.
John's point raised one big two-letter word in there, and that is the word if. Again, they made those promises on the Kyoto Protocol when it was binding, and many of those nations missed badly on all their targets, including our friends who are hosting the 2010 Olympics right now, the Canadians, who were some 50% beyond their original pledged target. You know, pledging a target is one thing. Actually putting in place a policy that can meet that target is the hard work. And it's the work that often never gets done. And unfortunately in the U.S., when we say we're going to agree to a treaty and when we sign up for that treaty, we are forced by law and by regulations that we put in place to abide by that treaty under the subject of penalty if we don't meet those things. And in Europe and in other places, they aren't just stuck to those type of rules. And that creates a real sticking point for any kind of treaty like this.
Here's an email from David, who's in Atlanta, Georgia, who says, today's show has Myron Ebel stating that one pro-climate change motivation is to destroy the economy. Nobody wants to destroy their own economy. That's a straw man defense. However, current energy companies have a huge stake in not developing new forms of energy and are willing to fund people such as Mr. Ebel to protect their income. Myron Ebel, how do you see that?
I see that as tendentious and misleading. You know, most of the big energy companies are now supporting, not opposing, some kind of action. This is particularly true in Europe, but it's also true in this country. If you look at the major oil companies, two of them are members of the U.S. Climate Action Partnership, which supports cap and trade, BP and Shell. So I think you have to look at the economic motives in a little more sophisticated way. The fact is that a lot of big companies have figured out that they can get rich off the backs of consumers with higher energy prices. Duke Energy, a big utility in the South, is a classic example of that, and Exelon, a Midwest utility. But a lot of companies have figured out that if we can raise energy prices enough, we can make these uncompetitive forms of energy profit out of them. And John Broder is absolutely right when he talked about nuclear. And he said, yes, it's the most expensive way to produce electricity. Well, it's going to take, as he said, huge amounts of government subsidies and mandates to make nuclear power reactors, a lot of them, a reality. And so I think he made my point earlier. It's no surprise that the nuclear industry is riding this bandwagon because they see it as a way of reviving their industry, which has been stalled for 30 years.
Frank.
I think Myron is right about a couple of things. Utilities, especially, are investing heavily in renewables and, frankly, and solar as well. And it's a true sign that they see opportunity in a cleaner energy future, not necessarily just through the regulatory process trying to push those things on people, but also just the market right now that is saying, hey, there's real opportunities here. I mean, I'm seeing that with wind projects that I'm working on and solar projects that I'm working on. So I really do think there is an acceptance in the industry. So the reality, though, is that these policies are going to have a cost, and they are going to impact consumers dramatically. And again, the consumers that are often impacted the most are those that are at the bottom of the income scale, and we frankly have to be very aware of the unintended consequences of a lot of the policies like this that often are put forth.
John Broder.
Well, yes, it is an economic debate, and there are a number of utility companies, perhaps even the majority of the generating capacity in the United States, that are supporting some form of cap and trade. And what they're seeking is not so much higher profits necessarily or to fatten their bottom lines at the expense of consumers. What they're looking for above all is certainty and predictability. There has been a debate over energy policy in this country for decades now. And if you're operating a coal mine or a coal-fired utility and the prospect of regulation through the EPA or through Congress has to frighten you, and it has to frighten your shareholders. So you're seeking predictability, you're negotiating with members of Congress and the administration, and trying to know where you're going to be in 10 years.
Do you believe that that is fueling the anti-climate change debate?
I really don't know. I think that the greatest fear among those who don't want to see action is just what Frank has said, is that it will result in huge new spikes in energy costs, which are going to drive manufacturing industries offshore and hurt jobs.
John Broder, The New York Times, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And let's take a call in Door, Michigan. Good morning, Ian. You're on the air.
Hi. My question is actually it's more of a comment. I have friends who don't believe in climate change at all. And whenever I talk to them about it and say, hey, you know, saving climate and all that stuff, they get bullheaded and don't care. And then I work at a hotel that's LEED certified, and I talk to them about how it saves money and electricity and low-flow toilets, shower heads, sensors, all that stuff. And suddenly they're all on board. They're like, oh, yeah, it's a great idea. So maybe they might not like believe in something that, you know, they don't believe has to be saved. But suddenly, I mean, if there's a way to make to save revenue and, you know, save on costs and all that stuff, suddenly they're all for it. So, I mean, has anyone else noticed that at all?
Steve Cochran.
I mean, one of the things that happens in this discussion is that there is almost an unchallenged assertion that no matter what we do, it's going to cost more for consumers. And in fact, I think we all know that, number one, if we do policy right, transition can be managed really quite well. Number two, what's often not counted into this are the levels of efficiency that can come when you focus on something. I'm very focused right now on efficiency in my attic because I've got a bunch of ice dams that have been accumulated around from the storms. Huh. When I do that, when I make the decision that I should have done earlier, I'll actually save money on my utility bill. So the efficiencies and the opportunities that are built into this, we won't find unless we focus on it. And above all, I think what people people like myself and others arguing, saying, let's focus on this. Let's actually have national policy that focuses on this, and then we'll find out how quickly we can move. We don't know right now how far we can go, what sort of efficiencies we can actually build into this system so that we can, in fact, create those opportunities and those jobs that we know are out there. We're seeing other people take advantage of them. If we don't focus as a nation, we're going to watch other people do it. If we do focus, that opportunity exists.
Frank.
I agree with Steve on this. The problem is that will only take us so far and is the low-hanging fruit that we have to get first. But it's not going to be able to get us to meet some of the more aggressive climate plans that have been put forward in legislation and other. And
let's stop you right there. Do you agree with Frank's point that only the most low-hanging fruit is going to be able to be operated on, and beyond that, it's going to be very expensive?
I don't agree with that. I don't think, number one, I don't think either one of us know, if we're humble about what we know and don't know. Number two, history tells us that when we focus, we did it on acid rain, we did it on automobiles, we did it on getting lead out of gasoline. When we focus, what we find out is we can do a lot more than we thought we were going to do, but we don't do it unless we actually focus on the problem. That's what we need to do.
Frank.
The specific issues that Steve referred to were right, but those were small issues where we can address a specific technology to a specific issue. The problem here is we've got an economy-wide proposition that affects everybody in every sector, and it's many sectors that we don't even know about. So those are things that we're going to have to take into account. There will be unintended consequences. And I would just point to California as an example of how energy efficiency has been a champion in getting them to soften, flatline the growth that that they've had in California for the last 25 years. The problem is they haven't been able to reduce their emissions, and that's what's being called for by many.
Steve.
One of the callers earlier talked about the ozone hole. Remember when the ozone hole was a really big deal? And in fact, it was a big deal. And the world came together, not just a small amount, the world came together, negotiated treaties, phased out the use of those. And in fact, we don't hear about the ozone hole anymore.
And weren't there big debates about that ozone layer? John.
There were debates at the time, and particularly the industries that relied on the hydrofluorocarbons to manufacture refrigerants for automobile and industrial air conditioners, even the propellants for various fire extinguishers. They said it would be much more expensive. As it turns out, there were replacements for those refrigerants and propellants, and in fact, that treaty has been more successful than anybody dreamed of at the time.
All right. Mishawaka, Indiana. Good morning, David. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. My point is Jacques Cousteau, the great French oceanographer, scientist, and inventor, somebody asked him back in 1992 what would happen if global warming was real, and he stated the following. He said, if global warming is real, then the polar ice caps will melt, which is happening. And he said the sea levels will rise, which is happening. And then he said the coastal areas will get flooded, which is starting to happen. And then he said something that I haven't heard anybody else say since, and it's really quite serious. And he said as the coastal areas are flooded, all the chemicals that are in the ground and on the ground, like, you know, agricultural chemicals, lawn chemicals, pesticides, insecticides, fungicides, herbicides, all that stuff. He says it'll leach out to sea, and you know, says you'll have a massive marine die-off. And in essence, he says the oceans will just be toxic. And then he said as the marine organisms decompose, there'll be a layer of organic scum.
All right, sir. Thanks for calling. John Broder.
I think Dr. Cousteau was accurate in all of his predictions. What he wasn't able to answer was the time frame, how quickly the heating of the overall planet would lead to sea level rise of that magnitude. But the idea of toxic chemicals and industrial chemicals leaching into groundwater, seawater, has been shown even irrelevant of global warming. Whenever there's a major flood, you see the toxicity in the rivers, lakes, and ocean rise.
Steve, where does the debate go from here?
Well, the Congress has it in its and its power in its hands to actually create useful policy here. It's a tough debate, but it's definitely joined, and that's where we're going to be. We're going to see if we can actually fashion effective, efficient national policy.
Steve Cochran of the Environmental Defense Fund, John Broder of the New York Times, Frank Masano, he's an energy policy specialist, and by phone, Myron Ebel, Director of Energy and Global Warming Policy at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Thank you all so much. And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dory Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.